So good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the special CEO speaker series, which is sponsored by the Royal Bank of Canada. Very much appreciate their support for many years now. This is being webcast around the world to alumni around the world. If you all have questions, you can send them into hashtag Desitel CEO, and we'll share some of those questions with the principal later on. So we're delighted to welcome the principal to join us here at Desitel. I'll introduce her in a moment. First, we're going to be having a little different format is to have three students interview the principal. So I'll just briefly introduce them. From the undergraduate, we have Shazia Sharef, who is from Kenya, is a U2 student, worked in social work both in Kenya and India before she joined us here at McGill. Delighted to have her here. We have Matthew Ronald, who's an MBA student from Montreal. Worked, has a degree, two degrees like the principal, or soon to have two degrees, like the principal from McGill. Worked in business for a few years and came for his MBA after a degree in psychology. And he's going off to China on exchange in February, I guess it is, for about 3 or 4 months. So we have three, and then we have our PhD student, Carlos, who has a very impressive background. He's from Peru. And has a degree from a university in Peru. He worked in Washington and some very impressive institutions, and now is doing his PhD here at McGill after being a Sauvé Scholar for a couple of years. And he's working with Henry Mintzberg, among others, focusing on organizational learning. And so looking at some of the new ways that we're doing learning here at McGill and indeed around the world. So has a lot of interesting research to talk about. So we have three people to ask questions, and we are delighted to have Suzanne Fortier, our new principal, join us here. Suzanne is a native of St. Timothy, Quebec, and she has 2 degrees from McGill, a BSc and a PhD in crystallography. I hope I said that correctly.
Yeah, perfect.
Good. And she was most recently the president of NSERC, and before being the president, she was also vice principal of research and vice principal academic at Queen's University in Kingston, where she was also a professor in the Department of Chemistry and the School of Computing. So I'll turn over to Matthew now and the other three.
Thank you very much, Professor Moore, for the kind introduction. On behalf of Shazia, Carlos, and myself, I'd like to extend a very warm welcome to all undergraduate students, all MBAs, PMBAs, PhD students joining us here today. I'd also like to welcome those tuning in to our discussion via our live webcast. There's a lot to be said about the principal here in terms of accolades and accomplishments. In the interest of time, we're going to have to move it along a little bit. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, please join me in very warmly welcoming our much-esteemed guest and your new principal, Dr. Suzanne Fortier. As mentioned by Professor Moore, we'll be jointly discussing Principal Fortier's background and leadership philosophy for about 25 minutes, after which we'll expand the discussion to audience Q&A and Twitter questions. So Principal Fortier, just to kick things off here, you were a student at McGill, as Carl mentioned. You have a Bachelor's of Science and a PhD in crystallography that you achieved in the 1970s. As a former student, perhaps you could share with us your thoughts on McGill as you remember it at that time and discuss how it has since grown as a university, especially in the international context.
Yes, so my recollection of being a student here, first of all, I had a wonderful experience at McGill. You can probably guess that because I would not have returned if this was not the case. It was a very, very rich experience at McGill. I came here from a small village and I didn't speak English. And so probably I was, from some perspective, a high maintenance student. I never even saw that, because what I saw rather was a university that did pay a lot of attention to its students. And I felt very clearly that personal attention that McGill was giving to students. I was involved right in my second year in research projects in my discipline of crystallography as an undergraduate student, not speaking English still very well. This is quite extraordinary. So that is part of my experience. Also part of my experience was the professors I had. I had no idea that I would be taught by people who were absolutely the best in their fields in the world. And so my own professors were connected to all the great researchers in the field at the world scale. And we had Nobel Prize laureates visiting our laboratory. So when you're a young person, never has seen anything, you don't even know about Nobel Prize, but suddenly you find out what it is, and these are the kind of people you meet. It's extraordinary. And the last thing is the international character of the university. I came here because I was absolutely curious. I wanted to be in a different culture, a different language. So I thought I'll be immersed in the English culture and English language. This is going to be fantastic. Well, when I arrived, I realized that I was immersed in a culture that was far more diverse. There were students from everywhere in the world. And I remember vividly having friends, and you have to think about when that happened. It was right after the Six-Day War. And I had friends who were from Egypt and friends who were from Israel. So that is a great experience, again, for a young person to be able to talk to people, not at a superficial level, but with people at a very deep level about their experience in a period of conflict, and seeing the two sides and hearing from two sides. I think this is increasingly what we need in the world, is that we'd be able to be exposed to different sides and different perspectives. So this was my experience at McGill. It was pretty fantastic. And I'll turn to you now.
Sure. Because I think that's something we can certainly still be proud of. Yes. Diversity in the McGill student body, especially here at DisHotel, is something that collectively certainly is a point of pride for us.
Hi, Ms. Fautier. My question is, here in management, we face a challenging question. And it's one of those where, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? And by that, I mean, if you had to put the egg as your interest and the chicken as your resume, which comes first? Here, as soon as you enter school, we preoccupy ourselves in a lot of prescribed activities that will get us that one job that's very competitive to get. Yeah. And on the other hand, when we're in school, in classes, we tend to compete, you know, and try and squeeze ourselves in the little mid-range of the bell curve in order to progress. And so my question is that in DisHotel, how can we facilitate more collaborative learning and help our students move beyond perhaps, you know, individual competition and a little self-centered grade-seeking? Mm-hmm. And on a bigger perspective, what is the role of these pedagogical tools or this focus on resume building or interest building in producing students that are collaborative and can cope in the organizations of the 21st century, which is increasingly interconnected and increasingly integrated?
Yes. My view is actually you need to feel both, competition and collaboration. I've always thought that competition is actually very good. As long as you use it in a positive way, it's good to aim for something higher. It's good to think, I can do better. And often what stimulates you to do better is by watching others and seeing, well, they're there and I'm here. I think I need to go further. I need to be better. And you feel that competition, but in a positive way, as an incentive and a stimulation for you to do better. And as you know, I'm a scientist. You feel it every day in science, because in research, you've got to be at the leading edge. And so you watch people and you say, they're at the leading edge. I want to be there. So you sense that competitive spirit. And the key is to use it in a positive way, in a constructive way. Not to say, well, I'll give up, I'll never be that good, but to say, what are they doing and how can I be that good, and see it as something that stimulates you. On the other hand, collaboration is absolutely crucial. When I was in my job at NSERC, I used to tell people that research, in many, many cases, but certainly innovation, are team sports. You're not going to win if you don't learn to work with others. Because you cannot do it all. you cannot play all the part. If you're going to move something to market, you will need to have a group of people who each bring their expertise to the team and realize that. So it has to be a very high-performing team. So you need to collaborate, but a team that also feels the competition. So I always thought that both are good, but you need to use them in a very constructive way.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'd like to ask a follow-up question on Matthews. I was talking with Carl, and we're talking about this book, The First 90 Days.
Yes.
Of executives in top positions. You have had other executive positions. So, and I was counting the names, the days that you were officially in office, and it's pretty close to 90.
Yes.
If it's not 90, actually.
Yes. Might be exactly 90. I have to count.
Yeah. And I was talking with Carl that for some people will be 90 days to take the most important and drastic decisions, like in the putting up the priority on the agenda. For other people, will be more like learning about the organization. So my first question is, what is your assessment of your first 90 days?
Yes, my first 90 days. So I spent my first 90 days really immersing myself in what McGill is today. I wanted to connect with what McGill is at this point. I've been to classes. I've shadowed students. I've lived a life of students. I've talked to a lot of people, alumni, professors, staff members, people who are involved in the governance of the university. I've avoided at this point, my first 90 days, declaring what my three top priorities were because of a very clear sense that the priorities have to come from the community. I'm not an autocratic CEO who comes in and say, I've not spent a day at McGill. I can tell you what you need to do. I would find that a bit presumptuous because the priorities will have to be accomplished through the commitment and hard work of people. And actually, I have to tell you, because your professor is Henry Mintzberg, so I have to tell you that in my first few days here, I got a book from Henry about managing simply. And there's a phrase there, and just so much represented the way I thought. I thought, he's got it, and this is exactly what I think. And I don't remember precisely, but I'll tell you what he says. He says, why not, instead of thinking of our organization as mythical hierarchies of power, think of them as communities of engagement where each person is respected and returned that respect. And I thought this is absolutely correct for the kind, in particular, of organization we are. We're only people. That's the only asset we have. People. That's it. That's all. We don't have, every organization say that. They say that in the oil and mineral business, but they do have assets on the ground. We are, all our assets are our people. And I think he's absolutely correct that we need to think of ourselves as being part of that community, and that it is the strength of our commitment to that community and our engagement with that community that is our advantage. And so in my first 90 days, I've been listening to what everyone has been telling me. I have one advantage. Sometimes you get lucky with genes. I have a very, very good memory. So my mind is filled with a lot of good ideas and that I've heard. But I have the privilege, I think, of seeing a perspective that very few people have the privilege of seeing, because I see the university as a whole, while most people see little pocket here, and there. And then I start seeing the big picture and connecting all of these things. When you put them all together, create an incredibly exciting picture of McGill, a picture that I can see in the future. So that's been my first 90 days. Absolutely fantastic.
Thank you. Actually, a week ago, I was with Henry, and I said, Henry, I have to prepare some questions for the new principal. He said, and then he said, well, she read my new book.
You're going to test me on the book. Chapter 3 said, what do you think?
So a very refreshing response. It's always encouraging to hear about, you know, leaders with an ear to the ground and concerned about, in fact, the concerns of, you know, whether it's their employees, whether it's students. So that's something certainly very admirable. Here at the CEO Speaker Series, we love to ask leaders about how they cope with the tremendous pressures associated with their role. It's certainly a favorite question of Professor Moore's. And perhaps it would be appropriate, therefore, to ask you, as a high-level leader and as a woman, what can you tell us about your view on work-life balance?
Okay, work-life balance. One thing is, first of all, you have to learn very early on to not fret the small stuff. I mean, there's a book that was written about it, but it's absolutely true. There are things that are absolutely important, and they need your total commitment, all of your energies. There are other things that are less important. I'll mention just one thing, and it will seem very superficial, but it is actually in the life-work balance important. I love to be with my friends and my family, and I love to cook for them. Well, I have not as much time to do that. So I told all my friends, you know what, let's not fret too much about it. We don't have to serve each other 7-course meals. You know, that's nice, but it's not necessary. We're going to have picnic. I call them picnic, you know, these kinds of meal where they're less formal. People don't expect you in the picnic, for example. You take your picnic, normally you eat outside. Well, nobody will expect that you cook your famous cheese souffle, because it's going to be pretty deflated when you take it to the ground. So you do things that are good, but don't put unnecessary demands on yourself. So that's one thing I've learned. The other thing I learned, and that was very early on in my career, and it came from a woman. It just was perfect thing for me to hear. She said, 2 out of 3, you know the expression, 2 out of 3 ain't bad. So here's the 3 things that you can have in your life at a very broad level: your career, your family, of course, your career, and the rest, your cultural activities, time with your friends, all of that. She said, at any given point of your life, most likely you'll have only 2 out of those 3. So at a period when you're early on, when you're a student, often you have your friends and the cultural activities and your studies, your career. Then you move on to having the family and career. And then eventually, the kids do leave home eventually. And then you go back to having a career and cultural activities and friends. So it will change through your life. Don't fret too much about it. I remember actually fretting a little bit because I found that I was becoming a totally uncultured person, no time to read, no time to go to theater and music show and all of that. But I realized it will come back. It will come back. But right now the priorities are the family and the career, and that's what I have to put my time on. So I think if you see how you can balance everything and without putting on yourself some totally unnecessary, unrealistic expectations, you can manage quite well, I think.
Just as a quick follow-up, did you feel those decisions to focus on sort of the 2 out of 3, were those always under your control? In other words,
no.
Did you have a sense of agency in pursuing which, you know, 2 or perhaps?
No, they're not under your control. And I think that's the most difficult thing, actually. And I think particularly for women, we like to have a control over our life because that's our way to cope. And we control things so that we manage not to waste time and so on. Everything is very well controlled. I tell people, because it's absolutely true. You may know in computer science there's a search algorithm that's based on the traveling salesman. I don't know if you've heard about that. This is hardwired in my brain. It drives my husband crazy, because I always tell him the route to take with whenever we have several stops. I said, first you go there, then you go there, then you go there. He says, you know, this is not necessary that you tell me how to route. But it is the control of saying, I don't have time to waste, therefore everything has to be under my control. But there are times in your life where you realize that, well, you don't control everything, so you do get pregnant. It's not totally out of your control, but it's not totally in your control either. Let's be clear. It's not totally. A little bit, but not totally. Illness yourself or members of your family, it throws your life out of control there, because you didn't ask to have cancer. You didn't ask to have a major illness to face, whether it's you or your child or your spouse. You have to cope with it. And what I think is extraordinary is that when life throws things like that at you, you manage to do it, and you learn enormously from it, and also you see the silver linings. And that is extraordinary, because you might say, well, there's no silver lining in getting sick. Well, we can all be surprised by the fact that often there is.
Things happen, absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Looking at the time, why don't we aim for two more questions, then we can pass it off for audience questions and answers.
All right, sounds good. This is actually not a prepared question, but you mentioned that you were able to shadow a few positions here in your first 90 days. So, did you manage to go to any club activities?
Love
and
that.
What was your favorite club, maybe as a student, that you kind of came back and you said, you know, I could see a lot of associations working together, and this is kind of
club activities since I've returned.
Since you've returned.
Well, I've participated. You know, there was a day of community engagement, so I participated in that. It was actually an eye-opener, because you may know, many people don't know that there are all sorts of gardens on campus where people grow food, and they've actually developed special containers for city growing, and so you have these containers on concrete structure, and the food is given to people who don't have the ability to buy good nutrition products. So it's an eye-opener, because first of all you realize that you've walked through campus and you haven't even seen them, but it's an eye-opener also to see that this is absolutely 100% student-initiated projects. And when I went, actually, I went to the club nights and to learn what was happening. It's what surprised me the most was that at least half of the 300 and more clubs on this campus, at least half of them are either related to social engagement, leadership building, environmental sustainability issue. And that was something that surprised me, because in my days as a student, I must say that we were coming out of a Quebec awakening to the world and being a fairly prosperous society. You know, we knew, of course, that there were people who were not having an easy life, particularly in some parts of Montreal, but we did not have as keen a sense as I think many people have today that beside us are people who are really struggling and people that can use our help, and that we can help as a community. And there's a lot of that on this campus, far more than when I was a student. So that's been a wonderful discovery.
For me, it's interesting, because I always was engaged. And when I came from Kenya to McGill, from a high school of 500 to a school of thousands and more than 200 student associations doing what they do personally, It's really empowering, for sure.
Yeah, it is. I must say, when I was a student, so I did a lot of things also outside the campus. And it may be because of where I came from, where In Saint Timothy, I have to say, the great musicians of this world do not perform in Saint Timothy. And so to be in Montreal and have these experience of hearing the greatest violinists in the world, Itzhak Perlman, Yehudi Menuhin, and Jean-Pierre Rampal with the McGill Chamber Orchestra, that was an extraordinary experience for me. So I was at every concert of the Montreal Symphonic Orchestra and the McGill Chamber Orchestra, and also j'ai pris mon courage à deux mains, as we say in French. I was very courageous. Curious, but for this, I was very courageous. I took dance class with the Ballet Jazz de Montréal and so on. And so I wasn't the best in the class, and it taught me. Actually, this is something I found. And I would say that it is an important experience to do something that you love, but that you're not all that good at. It teaches you a lot. It teaches you about the effort that we have to make. It teaches you, of course, about humility. And in dance class, I have to tell you, you know, when you see yourself in the mirror, you can come out of that pretty humble. But it is...
I can relate to that, that's for sure.
But it is, you know, it is such a good preparation for a person who's going to enter the academic world and who's going to be in a teaching position. It makes you understand that people may really give it their best, and this is what their best look like, and you should encourage them and you should reward for that. And it teaches you a lot about what will make you perhaps a good professor. Is to be in that environment. So these were some of the things I did when I was a student here.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much, Ms. Fautier.
I'd like to take the final question from us a little bit with a broader perspective. My question is basically, what makes a Canadian university Canadian? And I'm just going to explain a little bit. As an international student, last year there was all this debate around the country on the tuition hikes because of the cuts on the local governments. And it was a very interesting discussion because some arguments were like, okay, we should look more like the American university. Yeah. Underneath all the arguments, we should be more like the European university. And for McGill, it's very relevant. It was like funded by the British culture, looking to competing with American schools, having France also very close. Yeah. So my question is not about the tuition hikes.
Yes.
It's about... In that discussion, there are like values about what is being a Quebecois and what is being a Canadian that should be reflected in the university. So should the university just try to like copy and compete to just go up the rankings on school, which is important, or there's some elements of a Canadian university that makes it Canadian that should be protected?
Yes. So I should tell you at the outset that I've lived in several countries. I've lived in the U.S., I've lived in the UK, in Scotland, in Italy, and in Greece, and I've worked extensively with France, and particularly with the higher education, with the universities there, the UK, Denmark, Germany, Japan. So I've had a chance to look at your question. So, I won't compare us just with the American universities, but with all of these universities, Europeans as well as American, British. We're far less hierarchical than many universities in other countries. So, in many European universities, for example, you will usually see a situation where there's a very hierarchical system at the professor level. So you have the senior professors who are at the top, and many a times junior professors actually work within their lab, inside their lab, and the junior professors come in and they have the worst condition possible because the best condition are reserved for the senior professors. Canada's the reverse almost, we do everything we can in Canada to give our young professor a chance to get a good start. We reduce their teaching responsibilities. We try to give them the funding they need to get their research program started. So we do everything to equip them for success. That's not true in many universities where, in fact, they have a very, very difficult problem. And if you look at policies in other countries, you'll see that Japan, France, Germany are looking at that as a real problem. You look to the U.S., so if you look at the figures, for example, of their two major granting agencies, NIH and NSF, you're well over 40 by when you get your first research grant. Can you imagine? The average age for getting your first research grant at NIH is 43 and NSF is 41. So this is not equipping people for success. The other thing I see in Canadian universities is that we have really, I think, maintain our commitment of equality of chances, equality of opportunities. What you need to get in a good Canadian university is your record of commitments and achievements. Where you come from, if your parents are well connected, they have money and so on, doesn't play in the admission policies of our Canadian university. You get in solely on the basis of what you have done as a student. That's not true in many countries. In many countries, who you know and where you come from, and if you're one of the blue blood family of that community, plays a big role. That's not true in Canada. These are incredible advantages that we have in Canada. And I think it's something that Canadian universities are committed to. As you know, in this university, whenever fees are increased, 30% of the increase goes into bursaries so that we can make sure that people are not turned down because they can't afford to come here, but you know, it's solely on the basis of your academic achievements and your achievement more generally. These are precious, I think, characteristics of Canadian universities. These are two that readily come to mind.
I'm very glad to hear that because sometimes we see university authorities and making decisions to go up on the rankings that not necessarily are in tune with the values of,
yes,
of the culture.
Oh yeah, and you know, we've had, I don't know how many rankings since I've arrived, at least four that I've been talked about. So let me say just one thing about rankings. I had to say it also with McGill being ranked first in Canada. They're not a rigorous scientific exercise, so let's remember that. So whether McGill is one, two, or three, well, it's probably in the error bar. However, at a fairly gross level, they're probably about right. You know, McGill is most certainly in the top. But with, you know, at the detail level, probably we shouldn't think of those as very accurate. On the other hand also, and that's something that's very important to me, you should not use those rankings as a way of learning what others are doing and becoming more similar to them. That would impoverish, I think, our system of universities. To me, what is most important is that McGill, as and other universities, McGill or Université du Québec à Rimouski or ETS, that each of those institutions has a clear sense of what makes them unique, what gives them their own identity, and that we should build on that. That's where we're going to get a really good and rich array of universities in our country, is if each one of us can build on what makes us different from the other, not what makes us the same as another, but what makes us different. And McGill has a lot of wonderful characteristics that we can build on. And there, though, we should ask government to give us a little bit of flexibility, because if you have a funding formula that is putting you in the mold, you will not achieve that. You need a funding formula that gives you enough flexibility so that there's not a mold that we should all conform to, but rather that encourage us to develop what is unique about us. And that's what I want to do with this community in the next 5 years.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Principal Fortier. So that concludes this component of the discussion. I'd like to turn it over to Shazia now for about maybe 10 minutes of audience Q&A.
I'm sure they're burning questions after these amazing answers. So the stage is on. All right, we'll have this beautiful woman here.
Yeah, so I'm an undergraduate student here at the Digital Health Faculty. I'm interested to know, in the next few years, what are some steps needed to make the Digital Health Faculty of Management more competitive, both globally and nationally?
Okay. I'm impressed, I must say. I've followed the Desotel faculty for quite a number of years because, as you know, I was at Queen's University in the past. So, a university that had, I must say, had a slogan at football game, "Kill McGill." However, not that it is competitive. It is actually, what I will say is this, the faculties of management or business schools generally in Canada are part of a very dynamic groups of faculty. And it's not surprising because the whole sector is moving at such a fast pace and is changing at such a fast pace. We just have to think that it's not so long that we've moved from economies that used to be quite national or local to global economies. So there's a lot of activities and a lot of changes in faculties of management. The Desotel has had an incredible period of transformation that has brought it as one of the great faculties of management across the country. So we need to continue on that path. And I think from what I know at this point, part of the elements that can distinguish Desotel is, first of all, the international composition of both the student and the professorial bodies. I think this is the most international faculty of any in Canada. This is an incredible strength because this is where it's happening. It's at the global level. So you have your microcosm of what it is that you're entering. So that's a big, big advantage. The other one is, to me, is the opportunities for active learning experiences, whether it is through various types of internships, putting your hands in the action. And again, this is something that can happen here because not only we have a great city in which to put that in practice, but we have the whole world in which to put that in practice because we have alumni all over the world who are prepared to work with us. So this is absolutely fantastic. Some points that we'll not have to work on, I know, during my term, is certainly, I wouldn't say better lodging, but bigger lodgings, because I keep hearing that you could use a bit more space here. And that is something that has been, of course, discussed for many, many years, but I think that is becoming more and more of an issue that we need to deal with. So.
Thank you, Ms. Fortier. Do we have another question in the audience?
Yes. Hi, I'm an MBA student. From an OB perspective, I think it's only human for people to feel uneasy with change. And as you stepped into your leadership role, mm-hmm. How are you able to gather that support from people that perhaps were skeptical of your mission, your position?
Let me see now. I think you're absolutely right. It is difficult for people to face changes. So you're talking about me personally coming as a new principal and the threat that may cause to some people.
Sure.
Well, first of all, I'll tell you a little bit about how I've worked in the past and why I think I hope that I have not created that sense of insecurity. I have a view that when you enter a new organization, you have to give people the time to know you and you to know them. And I've had, I must say though, I've had the privilege of always joining organizations that were in a good shape. So, and I have to say that because if you come into a situation that is terrible, you need to act quickly and make changes. People are ready for it, in fact, if the situation is very bad. And I've not had that in my career, so I've been fortunate in that sense that I followed, I've entered institutions that were in a good shape. So I've always thought that, I practice it, that it is important to take the time to know people and for them to know you, and give people a chance also. I've never been, you know, you hear that sometimes where people come in and they bring their own group of people. I've worked with fantastic people when I was at Queen's and then when I was at NSERC. And in both, when I arrived at NSERC, people said, well, are you going to bring your people from Queen's? I said, absolutely not. You know, I know they're very good, but there are good people here. Why would I say to you goodbye because I'm bringing my own people? You know, the first thing you do is you work with people, you learn who they are, what they do, and they have built the institution. You need to make sure that everyone has a chance to demonstrate their commitment and their strength to the institution. And it's the same thing as I arrive here. People ask me, are you going to bring some of your people from NSERC that you work so well with? Well, there are really good people here. I would feel that would be not appropriate at all for me to do that. So that's one way to diminish at a very personal level, you know, because people are worried when a new principal or CEO comes in that they're going to be displaced for no good reason except that, you know, they want to bring people that they know. That's never been my practice. And so that has, I hope, reduced some of that fear. The other thing is, as I said, my role here is not to tell people what they need to do, but rather to see the potential of what they can do, to support them, to help them realize what it is that they can do. That's the way I see my role. In fact, that's the way I see the role of all of us in so-called administration. It is to have that ability to see what is potential and to help make it happen. We need to be yes people. We need to be people who say, you want to do that? That's a great idea. Let's see how we can do that. At times you have to say no, because you have to say something, person, we've looked at it, we've looked at the plan, we can make it happen. It's important for people to know if it can be. And as you know in business school, of course, you have to have solid business plans when you want to make big changes. So you need to be able to do that. But your first instinct has to be yes. If it's a good idea, yes, we can make it happen. We think we can make it happen. Let's work together. Let's see how we can get there together. That's very much the way I see my role.
Thank you, Ms. Fautier. Do we have another question? Yes?
Hi, thank you so much for coming here to speak with us today. I wanted to, it's a comment slash question. I wanted to commend McGill and yourself for what I can only assume has been a very trying experience dealing with the Quebec Charter of Values. I commend the stance that you take on it. And I was wondering what the experience has taught you about, you know, McGill as a community, mm-hmm. within a larger community, and how, you know, you deal with some of that give and take. Yes. From a larger perspective.
Yes, thank you. There's something I've learned it early on in my career, and I think it's a very important lesson to learn, and that is that you should know clearly what are the fundamental principles that you always have to commit to. And there's no give. In a lot of things, there's a lot of give. You know, there's, you know, your view, my view, maybe we can meet in between and so on. Maybe we can find a way. When it comes to fundamental principles, whether it is integrity, respect for people, there's no give. you've got to be 100% committed to that. And I first arrived here, and I think it was at the time when the charter, the proposition on the charter was made public. This university has made very strong commitment to the principles of respect for diversity and inclusion, and in fact, to the promotion of diversity and inclusion. This is embedded in our policies in the Senate and the Board of Trust, Board of Governors. And you have to be prepared when the time comes when you have to use and live by your principles to say it clearly. It may not be the most politically wise route to take, but this is a case where you have to put the politics behind. The principles are more important. And you have to know that. You have to know that clearly. When I arrived here, on my first day at work, I was interviewed and people asked me about the charter. And I said, I think I should first talk to the community at McGill because it's my first day at work. But within a week, I had a chance to talk to every student leader, leaders of our student society, the leaders of our employees groups, and everyone was in agreement that we should speak up. We reviewed our policies in Senate. What had happened here? It was clear that the community had been extensively consulted on these principles. So I had a very, very solid foundation where I felt I can speak on behalf of the community. So I did in September. Further, now that it is a projet de loi, it's now a bill, both the Senate and the Board of Governors have voted on a resolution to affirm that. And we will be going to the commission parlementaire. We're submitting a brief and we'll be going to the hearings. We request to be at the hearings to express the view of our community. So to me, and that is something that is so important for people like you, you're going to be, most of you in business, you're going to face those tough decisions. Is it better for the business? From a business perspective, this might be good, but actually it might go against some pretty fundamental principles that we think we have to live by. And which one? To me, the question always has to be, the principles always go first. This will always be the better answer. It might have a short-term impact that is not positive, but in the long term, it's always the best answer. So.
Yes. Okay, so this is, I'm going to interrupt you a second. This is going to be the last question for tonight. Question. I'd like to know what your take is on balancing good research and good teaching, given it's not necessarily the same skill set. Thinking of those rocket scientists who get in the classroom and have a hard time, you know, passing on knowledge.
Yes. So my thought is that increasingly, we've got to bring the two together. And that is simply because of all the great things that have happened, particularly in making information so readily accessible to us. So there's no need for professors to teach in the way that professor used to teach and tell you the facts for you to remember. It's out there at your fingertips. And so the kind of teaching that we need to increasingly bring in our classroom or outside of classroom is much more similar to the research process, which is, here are the facts. What do I make of that? Where does it lead me? What is the creative leap that I can make to bring me somewhere else? What are the things I need to challenge? These are all research. This is the way you do research. here's a great hypothesis that I have. I've looked at this and that, and this is a great hypothesis. Now, an hypothesis not tested, well, you know, particularly in the science discipline, any scientist will tell you that probably 75% of the hypotheses do not materialize to be actually proven in the laboratory. So we know that we can have all sorts of hypotheses out there. We need to have, again, the kind of research methodology to say, I think this is a great idea. Well, how are you going to test that? What will make you know that this is a great idea? What are the things? So the two increasingly need to come together. And that's the great thing about this particular time, is that what we need is not only the knowledge, we need knowledge and creativity. And bringing research into our classroom is a way of bringing knowledge and creativity together. So it's exciting to me.
Thank you. I'm going to pass it on to Matthew now for the questions.
Thanks so much, Principal
Forcier. <Carl. laughs> He was looking at me right now.
Hopefully the mustache gives it away.
Are you doing Movember?
Is that better? Sorry about that.
Okay.
Yes, I'm doing Movember. That's my only excuse to look this ridiculous.
Felicitas,
yeah. Carl actually said that he looks like Carl in the 70s, so.
Okay, there you go. Thank you all so much for the great questions. We really do appreciate them. I'd like to hand it off to Carlos now. We have two questions from Twitter, which he'll be moderating for the principal.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask the two questions, like, literally as they appear. The first one is, what role do students play in the adaptation of recent financial circumstances at McGill University? I'm going to reread it. What role do students play in the adaptation of recent financial circumstances at McGill University?
Yes, so I've always done, because I followed the Prêteur Érable from afar, I read the paper, I saw what was happening on TV. I always thought that the debate was not about the essential points. The debate is not, to me, really about whether you pay $2,200 or $2,500. That's not where we should center the debate. It is about the quality, certainly, and I think students should be asking for very high quality education in their universities. And it is about accessibility. It is about what I mentioned before, equality of opportunities. You should be asking your governments and your universities to make sure that people of talent can get it regardless of their financial means. That's what you should be asking. It gets centered elsewhere. And sometimes, I think, without really knowing what that could mean. And I'll just give you an example. There was a group of students asking for free university, free tuition, no tuition, free universities. I've worked extensively in France in the last few years. So I'll tell you what happens from what I know of France. First of all, there's very little mobility. If you're born in Nancy, France, that's where you study. You don't study in Bordeaux. It's far too far from home. And yes, you have free tuition, but you don't have much help in terms of financial aid. I work with colleagues in France, and I wanted to do a matching program combining us for mobility. At ENSEC, we had a lot of money for student scholarships. They had zero. So it's not possible. So that's what I saw there. The universities are not in a very good shape. And students, if they went there and look closely what's happening, I'm not sure they'd want that. If you look at, for example, the French system, the best institutions are often the grandes écoles, what they call grandes écoles, and they're not free. So, you know, but the question is, to me, is if a student wants to come to McGill and has the talent to do well here and will commit to the hard work that you need here, then we should make that possible. And it may mean, and I've lived that through Queens, and I must say that it actually worked very well. It may mean that another student whose family is quite well off will pay more. You don't want to go to ridiculous levels, but it may mean that students who are in families that have the means to pay may have to pay more than those who don't have the means. That's another model. I don't think it was seriously discussed here. And I think it's because the discussion appeared to me not to be centered around the fundamental values or principles, but about the technicalities. And before we get to how we're going to do that, how are we going to ensure accessibility, let's ask ourselves what it is that we want when we say accessibility. What do we mean? I think if we can agree on what we need in terms of values and principles, we might have a better chance of finding the means to put that in practice. But if we start with the solutions without knowing exactly what it is that we want, it's going to be all over the map and nobody's going to agree because we jump to the solutions without thinking clearly about what it is that we want. So I would start the discussion there. And I think the students are the ones who have the biggest leadership role there because it is, at the end of the day, it's your education, it's your time, and your voice is the one that matters the most. So leadership in our student to get us to think about education and what we want here and the principles that are important to us is where we need your leadership. So, c'est ce que j'aimerais bien voir à McGill.
Thank you. And then the final question from Twitter. What did you want to be when you were a child?
Oh, when I was a child? I wanted to be a writer. I loved reading. I was reading all the time. I was one of those kids who was scolded for reading too much. So I thought maybe I could be a writer. And I did write well. I was one of the top students in my French class, littérature française. So it was. But I also wanted to be a chemist fairly early on. And I did ask my parents to give me for the holiday as a gift a little chemistry set. I was about 10 years old. My parents, you know, we lived in a small village, and I mean, they were not, my parents did not have the chance to get even a secondary education. So imagine a kid said, Maman, je vais avoir un jus de chimie pour Noël. Maman said, well, wait a minute, what is that and where can we find such a thing, you know? But they did. They did. And I probably was one of the few kids, the only kid in my village who had the chemistry set. I was very proud. I had this little chemistry set at age 10. I loved it. But that is the thing. You know, we all have, when we think about what happens in our lives, we all have these lucky things that happen to us. And for me, it was to have parents like that. And my parents didn't know about many of the things I wanted to do, but they always said, you want to do that? We'll try to make it possible to. I remember another one of my crazy ideas. I love to read, and I had seen that there was a French publication, and so I wanted to have a subscription to that French publication. Imagine my parents, never been outside of Quebec, they have to write to France and pay in franc for this subscription, which they never knew of any currency practically than the Canadian currency. So this was an enormous thing for them to do, to say, how are we going to do that? You know, in franc, we don't even know how that works and so on. But they did it. They did it. I mean, it's a lucky streak. Lucky streak to have people like that see that you have a dream or a goal and say, well, we're not too sure, but we'll do our best. And I think that's something that they left with me and that I carry. I carry in my job now. sometimes you'll come with your dream and I'll say, I'm not too sure, but I'll do my best. I'll do my best to make it happen. And that's something I learned very, very early from my parents.
Thank you so much, Principal Fortier. And on that note, we'd like to thank you on behalf of Shazia, on behalf of Carlos, and myself. We'd like to thank you for your time here today. You've been so generous with us and for your very thoughtful answers. I think I can say safely that we all collectively wish you the very best.
Merci.
In your new role as our principal and vice chancellor. And Shazia, actually, if you'll just reach behind the Diz Hotel banner, on behalf of our faculty, its students, and its staff, we'd like to present you. Sorry about that, to make it so difficult. We'd like to present you with a very small appreciation, a token of our appreciation. So
merci,
thank you so
beaucoup.
Much, ladies and gentlemen, once again, your principal and vice chancellor,
merci,
Dr. Suzanne Fortier.
Thank you. Ah, yes. Thank you so much. I have to tell you something. I'm sure many of you have read the book No Logo. I don't completely adhere to that theory, particularly when it comes to the McGill logo. So I wear that with pride. Thank you so much. Diz Hotel.
So just before you go, Matthew has been hosting the CO Speaker Series, and he's going off to Fudan University in China. So we got him a small gift as well. So we just wanted to present to Matthew and thank him for all his work. See you in the new year.
Yes.
It's in room 303.
Okay.
We need a break for a few minutes.
No, I just...